Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and has been broadcast on Preston, Swindon and St Albans Community Radio. Bristol Community FM's Chair Ali Grant and Manager Pat Hart have, however, suspended Dialect indefinitely due to a nearly 30-minute long interview of a speech by Bible scholar Gail Ripplinger, but we hope to be back in the spring. This week, we have Cleo Lake, who's carnival director and dance artist and activist from St Paul's Carnival, as well as Lawrence Hu, who's a poet, writer and activist. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. Call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But I'm joined first this week by Cleo Lake. Hi, Cleo. Welcome to Dialect.
Good evening, Tony.
Tell us a bit about yourself. How did you get involved with Carnival?
I've always been involved some way or form. I live in St Paul's. I was born in Easton, or grew up in Easton, and so I think I've attended every Carnival since I was born. I used to have a family business in St Paul's, and in more recent years, I've been involved as a dance artist and someone who would teach dance in the schools.
Now, the Carnival's been a bit jittery over the last few years, mm-hmm. having some years where it has and some years where it hasn't been able to to happen. Mm-hmm. Just take us through the last few years when it has and hasn't happened.
I can't take you through all of it because I only joined in 2012 after it was cancelled. So I joined at the AGM at the end of 2012 and I got involved off the back of a community meeting that took place in 2012 on the 28th of February. A lot of people will remember the date because that was the day when you couldn't get through the door at the Malcolm X. There was no space because everyone turned up because there was a very successful campaign that was basically leaked information to the community. And it was following that I joined. So I obviously have an awareness, but I wasn't part of the team then, so I can only really comment on what's happened since then.
So am I right in thinking the Carnival then went ahead in 2013, went ahead in 2014, but not this year?
That's right, yeah.
Why?
The main reason why, the reason why is because at the end of 2014, the previous manager and the event managers left the organisation, and it was very difficult for us to contract a new event manager. And we were categorically told by the safety advisory group, i.e. police, licensing, council, health and safety officials, ambulance, fire, that there was no way that we could tweak previous year's plans and deliver the Carnival ourselves.
But were they coming up with solutions? Were they saying, well, you need to pick up someone with these skills? Here's someone who might be able to do this job?
They just simply said to us, we admire your passion and your interest and your dedication, but we cannot allow any of this to happen without professional event managers. And we got close to we contracted one actually at the beginning of the year, having tendered it out end of last year, and sadly that person had a heart attack and could no longer do the contract, so he had to withdraw from that. We went on and found another team who were very, very strong on crowd dynamics and security, those elements, crowd safety, etc., etc. The production side of the team, it was a collective. The production side of the team were nice chaps, probably do more kind of middle class events, if I'm honest, not necessarily something of the nature of a Carnival. However, the other members of the team were very strong. They came together, they came down to Bristol, they weren't from Bristol, and they came to a safety advisory group meeting and they were torn apart and really came out of that meeting. They came with the intention of, you know, they knew, as we all know in the industry, that you have to work very closely with the agencies to make the event happen and to make certain events happen. And they came with the view that if the agencies were willing to work, then they would also be very happy to work on the project. However, they came out of that meeting saying that it was the most aggressive SAGE meeting they've attended in their 15-year career. So sadly, they walked away from us as well.
So that was because of the close questioning by who? By the city council, the legal people, police?
City council and police.
Were you at the meeting?
Yes, I was at all.
And what did you think about that? There's a balance here, isn't there, between bureaucracy on the one hand and Bristol being able to do it. Actually, we can do this on the other side.
I understand that as far as we can, we need to ensure that it's a safe event. And the plans on paper have to be excellent, and they have to also translate on the ground on the day. And there were gaps and issues with previous plans, and, you know, suggestions that there were parts of the plans that were flawed. However, they were agreed the previous year. I've looked through the plans, and it was quite frustrating not being empowered to be able to tweak the plans and make plans ourselves, just being told no at every instance, really. But, you know, I understand that the council and the police want a safe event, and, you know, as well as the ethos of the carnival and the culture, it's also very important that it is a safe event.
Do you think maybe carnival's just got too big?
I think the demographic has changed a lot, and, you know, we get more and more diverse audiences coming, and, you know, we've worked really hard as a relatively new team to really take heed on the call in 2012 from the community, which was an overwhelming message of take it back to its roots. And that's what we've tried to do, not necessarily with an intention of downscaling anything, but simply we're a charity as well, and our mission is to educate and extend the appreciation of African Caribbean arts and culture. So we were prepared to reshape the event with that in mind.
Give us an idea of the sorts of things you were prepared to do then to sort of try and make the event safe, because no one can ever guarantee it's going to be safe, any event.
It's not necessarily about what we were going to do to make it safe, but we have to, if there's something that arises in the previous year, you would have to, in your risk assessment, reference that and how and show that you've thought about it and anything you might do to try and mitigate that. So we were doing that, but it was also about the culture and the ethos and the education. So also looking at the areas, looking at the music policy, different elements to it. And also, you know, other things like really trying to build up our masquerade, procession, parade, whatever you'd like to call it, so that that is a key feature of the carnival, which has dwindled in recent years. I mean, it's still fantastic. All the schools love it. It's a real highlight of their year. And obviously, they were very disappointed this year that it didn't happen. But again, it's also about our own community coming forward and reclaiming their culture, really, and showing that proudly on the day, which is not only just about the sound system or being on the main stage, but it's also about participating and showing our journey as African Caribbean people in the procession.
Now, what about this latest debacle where the City Council have effectively said, George Ferguson has effectively said, well, actually, we don't think that the current committee is up to the job at all?
I think actually they're backtracking a lot on what they've said. I think they've been quite naive, to be honest, and haven't understood the range of issues that surround the reasons why we couldn't deliver a carnival. And I don't think they were particularly aware of the fact that we are only three acting trustees at the moment and a couple of co-optees and someone else who was strong but is on maternity leave. So we're a very slim team, and it hasn't been for a want of trying to recruit new people. Now we're in a crisis, luckily people are coming forward, but I don't think, and I think they'll hopefully they also recognise it, Arts Council and Bristol City Council, that the support hasn't been enough. And even if you think, well, from September we were having discussions, we were led to believe that it was okay for us to use some of the funding that we did get, because we did get some funding this year, to put on a grassroots showcase event at the Malcolm X. Because at the end of the day, all we were allowed to do in terms of licensing and an event this year was ourselves, i.e. I was the event manager doing the paperwork and all the rest of it. All we were allowed to do was an enclosed event at the Malcolm X. And we were led to believe that that would actually satisfy a number of our business plan objectives. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And I think the authorities will recognise that there could have been a much more support that was offered. I'm also being told that in 2012, when it was cancelled, there was a significant business plan in place to restructure the organisation slightly and really support the trustees. Obviously, I joined in 2012 and I became the chair because no one else was willing to. And I wasn't aware of any of that. So I didn't know about that. So they're bringing it up now, but they hadn't really brought it up in 2012 since. But it seems that as soon as certain people are no longer part of the package, that it's all of a sudden an issue. As soon as you have people saying, you know, we noticed that a lot of the jobs on the day wasn't even the fact that they weren't going to the African Caribbean community. They weren't going to local people full stop.
I mean, do you think, have you felt over the last couple of years that the council really want this carnival to succeed in its present form? Have they been really contributing, helping you?
When I joined, it was always a bit of a tussle at the safety advisory group meetings. But, you know, we came back after a cancellation in 2012 with a 2 a.m. finish and then a midnight. But there is increased pressure from mainly police, I'd say, but I'm sure council have a hand in it as well, to reduce the time and possibly try and move us to Eastfield Park. I do believe that the authorities do want the carnival.
That's not St. Paul's.
Well, it's not, and it will come. You can't just make sweeping statements without doing a risk assessment on what they propose. And, you know, I don't think it will happen for now, but I think as well, the reason the funding was withdrawn was because we didn't deliver our objectives, i.e. delivering a carnival, and other objectives such as not reaching the hard to reach, which has been laughed at quite a lot. They're now sort of going into the details of the event, and I think, but that's got nothing to do with why you've withdrawn the funding. So why are you putting that on the table?
It does sound a little bit bureaucratic. Is that how you feel?
I feel that because you have newish people in post in senior roles, they have no understanding of the African Caribbean community and the journey, and they have no understanding about statements that they might make or actions that they might do, what the consequences might be. And anything that could be perceived as trying to divide a community, I really don't like.
There is also this situation where we've got this Mayor George Ferguson at the moment, who's a former merchant venturer, former slave trading organisation, architect. This has got to have at least some people talking, saying, well, hang on a minute, this is actually a white elite telling us how to do things, and it's not their carnival, it's our carnival. We're paying our council tax. Why don't they just fund what we want to do?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's as simple as that, because you need to, because of the event management and the conditions that have built up over years, whereby it's actually the event management has gone way out of community hands, and it's going to take a number of years to get that back. But it's definitely something we're working towards. I don't feel that the mayor is naive enough to think that he can run the carnival. However, I don't know what other groups he's affiliated with. And, well, you mentioned about the merchant venturers. I mean, I think it's hard to separate the carnival, because it's African Caribbean and because of where it's come from. It's hard to, it's all part of the same jigsaw for me, because it's part of the journey. So when we know as well through carnival that, you know, it was about emancipation, it was about celebrating your culture, it was about freedom and all of those things that actually stemmed from enslavement.
Yeah, but it almost seems like you're being micromanaged now by white men.
You know, I think ultimately, until the African Caribbean people can really unite and come together strongly and have a legal identity and challenge the city or whoever else to get more rights and maybe, you know, their own piece of land, I think we're always going to have problems, because our culture is to perhaps play our sound systems all through the night, but now our culture is too popular. And I think, and, you know, it draws such a crowd. And I think what also worries me is the fact that other people can come into the city who are probably more resourced than some people who've always been here and have worked from day one. It feels like sometimes we're being edged out of our own culture.
So, I mean, I feel a bit the same with the traveller culture here in Britain. Things like the Stonehenge Festival originally was a free festival. Yeah. Yes, it had a few safety problems, but it was a free festival, genuine event. And that's been now taken over, like Glastonbury, by, you know, the sort of event management people, great big steel fence all around it. That doesn't really wash with the British traveller culture. Neither does it with the Afro-Caribbean, does it?
No. And it, of course, will change the nature of the event.
Just finally, are we going to get carnival 2016? And if so, what kind of shape will it look like?
Well, we've already had one community meeting, and we have another one coming up on Thursday, the 3rd of December, 6 o'clock at the Malcolm X, which everyone who supports Carnival and the organisation is welcome to attend. And that will really be about trying to recruit trustees. But even if that doesn't happen on the night, we will be working towards an AGM where we can get people on the board. We will be, you know, setting up steering groups where people with their, you know, they have their interest, their skill, will be put into a steering group. Can I also say that we will be jointly with Malcolm X Centre, which is also having its lease taken off of them by the council, although this is going to a legal battle. We will be joining the Malcolm X this Sunday, meeting at Malcolm X Centre from 11 a.m. to have a section in the March for Climate, Justice and Jobs, which leaves Castle Park at 12. So we're really appealing to not only the African Caribbean community, but also our friends to join us and to make it seen that we are a people, that we do have a voice, and that we do stand up. We will stand up, and that there are certain things that you simply cannot take away from us.
Cleo Lake, Carnival Director, thanks very much for joining us.
You're
on
welcome.
Dialect.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm joined now by Lawrence Hu. Lawrence lives here in Bristol, in St Paul's. He's a poet, a writer, a filmmaker. Have you actually made films, Lawrence,
as well?
I've
done a couple of documentaries and done pieces that have gone out.
Do you write about, what do you focus on in the films and the poetry?
Well, initially what got me writing and got my juices flowing was the crimes that were being committed against young people in the centre of Bristol. Due to, as far as I've seen it, negligence from the authorities. As in, we had certain inner city schools and places where children should feel safe, but they were actually designated as like vice zones. So one of the main places in Bristol for street prostitution was outside of a local primary school.
Well, that sounds like a no-brainer, doesn't it? You don't have an overlap between those two, between kids and vice.
Well, what's quite one of the things that really kind of hammered it home was when they put a sign up in front of the school sign, which said Mill Pond Primary School. They then put a sign up in front of Mill Pond Primary School that said, "Police warning, curb crawlers will be arrested."
Okay, so that was a film, was it?
It was.
Or a poem, or a bit of everything?
It ended up being a poem, but it was an unbelievable image to actually be able to, which I did, was photograph, take a photo, and in the same small image have a sign that said Mill Pond Primary School, and it also said a warning for the children to read as they go to school.
Sounds like, at the very least, something that Private Eye should have in, you know, as a kind of joke photograph. Can you believe that this could even exist? What brought you, tell us a bit about your journey, where you've come from, Lawrence, into actually getting your thoughts down in poetry and films, that sort of thing. Why?
I came through, partly through the care system, myself as a young person growing up. Was kind of identified as being bad. They said, you're bad. So I kind of got attracted to that lifestyle for a while. So I was drawn to the streets of Bristol. It wasn't difficult to find the other side of the line of normality, which I was quite drawn to and accepted by. And then you grow up, you mature. You can see, you kind of get a better grip of what's right and wrong. Grew up and then had children myself. And the main driver was that I didn't want my children to fall into walk in my footsteps, my early footsteps.
So what was the attraction at that? I mean, surely most people think, well, I want to at least try and reasonably keep on the straight and narrow. What was it that made you step over the line? And you're saying you were almost, you were in the care system, you were being told you were bad, and that made sense for you?
I'm one of the other drivers, didn't really well know, is when I was at school, you had an 11 plus. And I did the 11 plus and came in the top few percent in Bristol and was actually accepted for a free fee playing place at QEH in Bristol.
Yeah.
I went for the viewing, and 4 weeks after going on the viewing, was then told that we would have to find over 50% of the fee to attend, when originally it was offered as a free place.
So they're backtracking.
It backtracked. I put a lot of work in to do that. And I kind of rebelled.
So, I mean, it sounds to me like, you know, you're an educated person. You're pretty switched on. Was that important to you, actually doing something with that at 11 years old, being told, you're quite bright?
Well, it made me feel that it didn't matter.
That you mean you didn't really need an education, you were already bright?
Well, no, it was that. It's like, it doesn't matter if you have achieved, they don't want you.
Interesting. Well, I mean, I know you've had a look, as many people have, as I have actually, at the history of the city, Bristol, up until pretty much the Industrial Revolution, was Britain's second city after London. Mm. And the role of Bristol in creating the empire is pretty powerful and involves a lot of nasty treatment of the Afro-Caribbean. So I know you've been looking at that. Mm-hmm. What have you dug out about Bristol's history?
That's like the most open-ended
question.
Well,
where do we start?
Let's start early. Let's go back. Well, Bristol, I still rate Bristol like it is classed as England's and then second city. But I feel that it's England's first city, as in its national identity. Bristol's a very Bristolian English city. London is an international city. A lot of its wealth and power comes from other places. Bristol's is very insular. And you can see that because even when there was a dispute to do with the slave trade and who could have the main control of the ports and the shipping, Bristol actually managed to hold it for 25 years before it got moved away. We've had some of the first prime ministers come from Bristol. Some of the first banks, which are now the Bank of London, started in Bristol, Green Square. If you go on there, I think Barclays Bank started there, as well as the Bristol Bank, which ended up becoming our national
Well, these
bank.
Bankers have become quite powerful now, haven't they? While the rest of the country is under austerity, they're getting even bigger bonuses. The banks.
Yeah, they definitely. Well, it's the biggest travesty is the is 2008, which that the people allowed. Well, we didn't allow it, got done around us. But that I thought bankruptcy stood there for failing businesses, and the banks failed, but they weren't allowed to go bankrupt and we paid them out, which really has bankrupted England as a nation.
Yeah, it's totally wrong, totally unfair. It's like these guys are running things. But look, getting back to Cabot, he apparently discovered America, but he didn't, did he? Because America was already there.
Something has to be unknown to be discovered, doesn't it? It doesn't have to not exist. But going to Cabot, or John Cabot, Colston, all the way through, yeah, you didn't discover anything. You found a place, annihilated the groups of people there and took ownership. That's pretty much the truth of what actually occurred. But then the victors in any war or any oppression usually get to write the stories after. So we always get the viewpoint of somebody who's won and doesn't really want to identify the truth of what's occurred. So they try to put it in as floral and as nice. So we discovered these lands and there was nobody there.
I mean, have you traced your own family's history from the Caribbean or where?
I'm slightly fortunate. As in my last name, you might have noticed, is Hu, which is Chinese, and I still have it. So I can actually chase my lineage, not my African lineage, but I can chase my Oriental lineage actually back to China. So in that stance, I'm actually quite fortunate. Where most of the people I know of African Caribbean descent, their surname ends with a slave owner.
Right.
It'd be Williams, it'd be Mac this, or whatever. And when you trace it back, you get to a certain place, and then you get to records, and you find that it's owned, and then it ends.
Because we do see a lot of stuff about Cabot around. We've got Cabot Circus. Cabot mm-hmm. actually was really a kind of, you look at it in one way, and he was doing a reconnaissance for the Bristol merchants and other merchants, obviously, of a new land for them. And he was the initial guy who was doing the collecting information about what was to become one of the biggest genocides in the history of planet Earth, of the North American Indians. Yeah. So I mean, it's not really that is now celebrated, isn't it, here in Bristol, with our wonderful new Cabot Circus shopping centre. Yeah. And this guy is celebrated, even though actually he was the first step. He was really planting the seeds of the North American Indians genocide.
Mm. Right, it's him, John Cabot, another well-known person, Colston. Then you've also got John Hawkins, who the first ships that went out and transported people was through him. He's got his own school not far out of Bristol. Which is quite funny because I worked at Kumba, Artist in Residence, an Afro-Caribbean centre in the middle of St. Paul's. Once a year, pupils from John Hawkins School come down to watch a performance. And if you actually looks up John Hawkins' coat of arms, you will see enslaved people in his coat of arms.
How are they getting away with this, Lawrence? It's almost like it's been written out of history.
Well, until you go to record the other version of events, history is usually like just the victor story. So when you think, in all honesty, the slave trade created the greatest Holocaust and annihilation of indigenous peoples on the planet. But you think it was North America, South America, Australia, all the Caribbean islands, and other places, Polynesia, all these places, these people were annihilated.
Well, let's just go back to the Caribbean. At the moment, I mean, there were places like what's now Haiti, I think it was Santo Domingo at the time. The indigenous Indians who were there, were the British tried to get them to behave, I suppose they would say, but they wouldn't accept anyone coming and taking them over. So eventually, like in the Aboriginals in Tasmania, they were hunted down with dogs by men on horseback and killed and completely wiped out. And then the slaves were brought over from Africa to work the fields there. Now, this almost seems like it's poisoning the whole of the history by this kind of attitude. And I wonder, how much does Bristol really have responsibility for that?
I think Bristol was an incredibly large driver in the whole slavery movement. It built through. If you actually look at a map of Bristol before slave trade, and then look at a map through those 300 years, and you actually see the incredible growth of the city, where did all that money come from? And if you look at where the most of the money came from, it came through the suffering of African people.
Nowadays, I mean, we've got still, the merchant venture is still there. I mean, they go back to the 1500s. I mean, a little while after Jan Cabot, but then people will say, oh, well, actually, they were Bristol merchants that financed Cabot, even if the merchant venturers formally were created afterwards.
Adopted the person that we know as John Cabot. It's not his real name. He's Spanish, isn't he?
Ah, Cabotti, is Cabotier. It? Cabotier. Yeah.
And his first name, I can't pronounce it. But it was funded by an Americano. I think his name was Americano. I can't remember.
Yeah,
I can't pronounce his proper name, but that's the person who actually funded his voyages. It's funny that then the country that they found ended up being called America.
Oh, that's funny, yeah. And so it was the guy with the money. They named the continent, the entire continent, after the guy with the money.
We can have a look. I believe that the continent's named after the guy with the money. And then we change because we're quite good at adopting people if we see a benefit to them. It's funny, at the moment we've got a load of stuff about immigration, closing the borders, but one of the greatest sons of Bristol is a Spanish immigrant.
But what about the merchants today? Do you think it's a good idea to keep your eye on them? I mean, I've met some of them, former masters, current masters. I've interviewed some of them. And actually, one or two of them I felt were actually decent people. But they seem to have been slowly either died or elbowed out. And now I'm looking at the profiles of them. They're running our schools. They're running, for example, Bristol Water, things like that. And they seem to have sort of taken over where the government left off, you know, with Thatcherism and privatisation. A lot of the utilities, that kind of thing, the schools, a lot of them are now being academised, turned into academies, privatised. The merchants seem to have quite a profile in the city. Is this something you've looked at?
The merchants have always, in my opinion, have always controlled Bristol City. The city's been controlled through the ports. They controlled the ports. They controlled all the first avenues of trade. And they still control the trade in the city, the majority of it.
Well, they own the Downs. They seem to have quite a big influence on the council, don't they? And, of course, they've now got an ex-merchant, if you believe the ex, as mayor.
That's one of the funniest statements ever, isn't it? I've been a merchant venturer for 30 years. I'm going to go for mayor and I'm going to dissolve all my associations with the people that I've believed in for 30 years to take this job. Come on. It's a PR thing to say that he's no longer. Of course, you're still a merchant.
Well, the other thing,
it everything
is,
covered in name.
Well, the merchants still invite the mayor along to events that they do, and of course, he's still meeting with them. I mean, it may be stretching a point, but there does seem to be an extent to which a lot of the control, private control of our utilities, things like water, electricity, is a form of slavery, isn't it? I mean, you know, you've got to pay that, otherwise, you're going to be kicked out of your home, evicted, or freeze.
Yeah, so it's. It's things where it's control. Well, why would you want to relinquish control if you've had control?
And
that's
I suppose
a question.
You might want to roll out even more control and in the city. So, what do you think about the legacy? The Bristol. I mean, Bristol's well known as a slave trading port. The way that they did it, though, they kept most of the nasty stuff away from Bristol itself, didn't they?
Well, I think something. It's hard to prove some things, but one thing that's quite amazing about Bristol's secret network of roads is the, all the tunnels that run underneath this city. Now, the whole of this city is connected, yeah, through some of the biggest tunnels.
Well, Lawrence, if you go down to Exeter, which is another medieval mm-hmm. city, you can actually go under the city and they do tours around the what they call the conduits under the city.
Not in Bristol. Like, we're actually stood, we're above a tunnel right now, which goes from here to
We're in Stokes Croft, folks.
Yeah, well, King Square.
Or one of the Jamaica Street.
Yeah, King Square is one of the old entrances to it, which is just behind us. That tunnel goes to Portland Square down there, and then it goes to the docks. Now, rumour has it, because there's no records, many records have been destroyed so that certain things can be denied, is that the church there on Portland Square, which is one of only four Georgian squares left in England.
Well, that's St. Paul's Church. It's St. Paul's now Circumedia.
Circumedia. Yeah. Is that that's where they used to have the sails, was on the green. But they'd bring them from the docks, under the city, up through the pulpit, where the pulpit is where the entrance to the tunnel is.
So hang on, are we talking about Afro-Caribbean slaves?
I'm talking about enslaved people. I won't use the term slave because it denotes human beings, so I'll say enslaved
Africans.
Yeah,
good. That's a good term. Yeah. So because they do actually Irish, they were trading Irish slaves as well in Bristol.
Yeah, and they were the first to go to the Caribbean, but you know what happened? They couldn't take the heat. Now, when they're refining the sugar, the temperature in the sugar refineries got to over 40 degrees. Now, they died very, very quick. So the one thing with the slave trade, which isn't often discussed, is that they looked for a group of people that could actually survive the task in hand. And that's why Africa became so important, because they had to have people from a very hot climate who could work within the sugar refinery. And that's where the rum came from. But that was what happened. So the Irish went there first. They died very, very quickly. The heat was overpowering. So then that's why Africa became so important.
What about these tunnels then? What was the purpose of them?
And I think when a lot of people talk about the slave trade or things happening in Bristol, we didn't see it. We're not aware of it. The movement of a lot of these people was under the sea. That's why there's so many cut-off cities. They go all the way up Park Street, all the way to Black Boy Hill. Black Boy Hill is so-called named after a pub. Really? Next to White Ladies Road. We know about sailors. After you've been on a ship for a long time, you come off the ship, there's a few things they're interested in. And I got a funny feeling White Ladies Road is where they went after selling at Black Boy Hill. But they tell you it's not true.
Well, and also, of course, Bristol was a Templar port. I mean, you were talking about banking earlier. Mm. One of the key Templar sites in Europe, actually. I mean, we're talking about London. What do you make of these Knights Templar? They used to have their ships, didn't they, sailing around. They were the first multinational corporation, effectively. Yeah. The world's first international bankers with the
lender.
The red Maltese crosses on the white ships. Bristol was one of their most important cities.
Well,
Temple
Meads. As far as I understand, the very first Templar church was built in Bristol in about 11... It predates the one in London by about 50 years. And it's the church, I can't think of the name of it in town, but we just had a 30-day arts thing within the church. I think it might be called St. Stephen's Church now. But the original Templar church, which...
That would have been on the old quay, wouldn't it? On the old quay side.
Which around... The original round Templar church, which was built about 1150, is there. And it predates the one in London. That's why we have Temple Meads. And I believe that was their base.
It's funny, isn't it? Because it just occurred to me, you've now got Temple Quarter, which is this new area of big offices by Temple Meads. You've also got the pub, the Wetherspoons, the Knights Templar.
Are they playing? Come on.
Well, the other thing is, of course, they're still crusading, aren't they? Look at Israel. Yeah. Look at the Israeli state. What's happened over the years with the Balfour Declaration, the British creating Israel in the Middle East after the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Actually, well, they didn't create it. I suppose you'd say the Jewish terrorists at the end of World War II created this new state, but the British provided the land for it. Through the Balfour Declaration and the idea of creating this place, so it almost seems like we've got a kind of new breed of crusaders, both out in the Middle East and here in Bristol.
Well, I think kind of with the Knights Templars, they kind of morphed from the Knights Templars, came to England, re-established themselves, and kind of became the merchants. And I feel that's what the link is, and it's they then morphed into become the group called the Merchant Venturers, because they were chased out of Europe, weren't they, the Knights Templars, in the end?
Well, in France, certainly, yeah.
And, like, murdered as much as possible, so they had to reinvent themselves.
Well, one of the theories I've seen, which does actually some scholars will agree with, is that the reason the French Revolution was so bloody was vengeance by the Templars against the aristocracy in France, who had kicked them out. So possible. I'm not sure about that, but it certainly would fit, wouldn't it, with the mentality of the Templars. There's also, of course, the Freemason connection, because you'll get a brand of Knights Templar as part of Freemasonry. And if you look at the merchant venturers, you've got the master, as you would have in the Masonic Lodge, the master of the lodge. You've then got also the next year's merchant is called the senior warden, exactly the same in a Masonic Lodge. And the junior warden is going to be the master in 2 years' time. Mm-hmm. So exactly mimicking a Masonic Lodge.
Yeah.
What do you make of the Masonic stuff? Because some people think, oh, this is just a silly conspiracy.
Oh, well, this is really funny. My stepfather used to be the cook for the Masonic Lodge on the bottom of Park Street. So every now and then I could get in there and take a little look around the corner of the doors, and then I'd ask who are all these people. And it was all the most influential people in Bristol that used to be in there. And it's a group of people that look to look after their own interests.
Well, when I went in there, this is a few years ago, took some photos and put them online. Then I was with a friend of mine who was I suppose you'd call him a bit of a ne'er-do-well. He'd been in front of the magistrate a few times. And he said, oh, well, hang on, this guy is on the chair of the magistrates. And he was being ordered around by these Freemasons. And they said to him, you've got to spend an hour or so stood by a staircase to make sure no one went down the staircase. So you do wonder, don't you, if these magistrates are actually being ordered around by their higher ups in the Masonic Lodge, what sort of situation have you got when they're in court? Who's in charge? Are they really their own person?
No. I think, yeah, money controls most things, and it gives most people power.
And what about land? That's important too, isn't it? So Paul's is an important bit of land.
Well, it definitely is to the founding fathers of Bristol, as in the merchants and everybody, because St. Paul's was actually their first upper-class community in the beginning. A lot of people think by the docks was in Queen Square because of the buildings there, but they actually, in that period in time, Queen Square and all around Redcliffe stank from the docks, all the boats coming in, everything. So they moved away from there. And the first place was St. Paul's. That's why it's got all its beautiful Georgian terraces.
Well, if you think about Portland Square, those are big old merchants' houses, aren't they? With cellars and all sorts.
There's only four of those in England, those squares. Complete Georgian square with a church on it like that. That is one of only four that exist in the country. That's how important it was.
So what are your thoughts about the debacle over the carnival? Because St. Paul's really should be for the people, by the people. I would have thought, you know, this is a bit of a no-brainer. We pay our council tax and a few pounds of that goes towards a carnival which is organised by St. Paul's people for St. Paul's people.
I think ultimately the end goal is about grabbing back the land. Ultimately, that's what it's about. It's like, actually, we want this space back.
What, you mean the streets?
The streets, the buildings, the land, that we want it back. In the last few years, the prices in St. Paul's they've nearly trebled decade.
People will say all over the south of England, house prices are going up, Lawrence.
Yeah, but because it was held unnaturally down due to bad policing, lack of concern by the council, filling it up with hostels and allowing all those places, then all of a sudden they removed it all. Now there's good policing. And the council care, the dustmen are in cleaning the things, all the streetlights now work. So what it was suppressed its value. Now, if you were aware that it was going to suddenly become treated like any other community, there's a lot of money to be made in St. Paul's in the last 10 years.
Well, what about, hang on, because at the moment we've got this area where the cardboard factory used to be, which is just rubble, it's terrible.
That belongs to
Places for people,
which used to be Bristol churches, which had to close down due to over
This is housing association.
A housing association, registered charity, which had to change its name because of a massive fraud involving over £1 million to do with housing stock. They didn't disappear. They just reinvented themselves and came back as Places for People. They're still run by the church. If you find out who's the head of Places for People, I think you find out his father, somebody or other.
Oh, they're a national. Surely Bristol churches was taken over by a national thing, Places for People.
I still, when you see certain things of it, I still go back to Father. I can't think of his name, but it's from a church up in Clifton, who still sits at the top of
Places for People.
Places for
so
people
what's happening with
Bristol.
That land? No one wants to live around a rubble heap, which is effectively what it's been for years. And effectively, the people that bought that, Places for People, they're not actually building houses. They're speculating on the property value.
Well, in 2003 is when the planning permission came through for Cabot Circus. And it's one of the fastest applications to go through. Ever. People can check this if they can find the information.
Broke the sound barrier, didn't it?
It went through in 3 days.
Yeah.
It's unheard of. And from that moment when that went through, that's when everything started. People have talked about the gentrification of St. Paul's today, 2015. Now, the gentrification started in 2003. That's when everything was put in place. That's when they slowly started moving people out, but keeping it suppressed. So what was clever was people asked to leave. It's never going to change. Our children aren't safe. This is going on. So all of a sudden, houses, like places for people. Here's £5,000 to go and move to Hartcliffe, which is out on the edge of Bristol, into a brand new... So that's when the reclamation of the community...
You know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking, well, maybe places for people are sitting on that until the housing associations are given much more freedom by the Tory government, and then they'll do private development on it.
Well, what happened with it? They had a huge...
And make double the money, or quadruple or something.
You're exactly right. Initially, they had a big plan to do it, because what they're doing was saying, we're selling a lot of this social stock and getting rid of a lot of our social houses, and we'll now accommodate it within this new development we're doing. But as the recession came in and house prices, everything got unsteady, loans, lending, they were managed to renegotiate their deal. It's like, oh, well, look, we can't offer all this low-income housing now because it's really hard for us to make money on it. So if you look through the plans of what they've submitted to deliver, it's become more and more private, more and more private, more and more private. So now they've got a great plan. When nearly all the housing in there would be private, there would hardly be any low-income property, which what the land was sold for in the beginning.
Well, where's the voice for people in St. Paul's about this? Because whether we're talking about the future for that part of the city or the carnival, it doesn't seem to be there anymore.
I think with a lot of it, I think the voice is being drowned out. I think listening to Cleo's interview before, there she was saying, you know, we put all these propositions forward trying to make something work, and they found it very hostile and negative from the people that can sign these things off. So if the people who can sign certain stuff off aren't there for you, there's nothing you can do.
Well, for those people that think this, you know, sort of historical conspiracies, I would just point out the first Crusader king of Jerusalem was named Baldwin. And you might know that there is a big street in the middle of Bristol after him. So we've got quite a lot of connections. If you'd just like to wind up by telling us whereabouts we can find some of your work online. Actually, maybe if you're going to be appearing, people can come and see
you. You can find some of my stuff at lawrencewhu.com. And also on YouTube at Lawrence Hu UK.
So you spell that?
LAWRENCE. And my surname is HOO.
.com.
And then there's on YouTube, you can see some of the video stuff and documentary stuff at YouTube, Lawrence Hu UK.
Okay. And I suppose, and we're talking historically here, the fight goes on, doesn't it? For democracy, for equality, and for dignity.
I think people from all different ethnic groups need to come together, because it's rich against poor. It's not ethnicities against ethnicities. There's just a huge gap between what the haves have and what the have-nots have. And the have-nots have to stop looking at each other as different groups, which we're being programmed to do, and actually look at each other as one group. And the moment that happens, change can occur.
Okay, Lawrence Hu, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Right, I'm joined on the line now from Maine, which is part of New England. That's on the east coast of the United States, above New York, above Boston, by Bruce Gagnon. Hi, Bruce, and welcome to Dialect.
Howdy, nice to be with you.
Now, Bruce, tell us a bit about your organisation. It's called Gnorbens, I think, but actually spell that out for us.
It's called the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. It was created in 1992 to build a consciousness and ultimately a constituency around the world to begin to try to deal with this coming reality of U.S. space domination at the Space Command headquarters in Colorado Springs. Above their doorway, they have their logo that reads Master of Space. And in a planning document some years ago, they talked about how with space technology, the U.S. would control the earth below, basically on behalf of corporate capitalism.
Okay, well, tell us what's up there. What do we know about what's up there at the moment?
What's up there today is a slew of military satellites that direct all warfare on the planet, so the U.S. can see everything, can hear everything, and can target every place on the Earth below. And with that technology, they now have an advantage over every other country. They can direct soldiers on the ground, people in tanks, people in planes, people on boats, to their targets with this military space technology.
But, I mean, surely the Chinese, the Russians, they've got their satellites up there too. There's no, the Americans might want to dominate space, but they don't have a monopoly up there.
No, they don't, but they sure have a tremendous advantage. And now the United States is deploying so-called missile defense systems encircling both Russia and China. And missile defense is a key element in U.S. first strike attack planning. The idea is that you would hit them first in a first strike attack when they tried to fire their remaining retaliatory capability. So-called missile defense systems would take them out. So the U.S. formally was involved with Russia in the ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty, that excluded and disallowed, outlawed these so-called missile defense systems. But when George W. Bush became president, he walked away from that treaty. And since that time, Obama has escalated the program dramatically. And we now see today both Russia and China saying that all negotiations for nuclear disarmament are off as long as the U.S. continues surrounding both those countries with missile defense.
But, so, that's on the ground, the missile defense system. What's the connection with what's going on up way above the Earth?
Well, missile defense doesn't work unless you have satellite lights that can direct it to its target, unless you have ground stations like up at Filingdales and Menwith Hill in Yorkshire that can direct it to its target. So all of this space technology fits together into a seamless web. And again, the United States is far along, much further along than anyone else. There are really no competitors to the U.S. today. And the U.S. has demonstrated in the past that it has anti-satellite weapons capability, the ability to destroy other countries' satellites, and also leads today in cyber warfare, which allows essentially the U.S. to try to shut off other countries' computers before they're attacked so that they're not able to have their early warning systems in place so they don't see the U.S. coming. This is what the U.S. did in Yugoslavia some years ago.
So what did they do in Yugoslavia, Bruce?
They shut down the air defense system, so they were not able to protect themselves when NATO warplanes bombed Yugoslavia. Not one NATO warplane was lost in that so-called war. So clearly the advantage of cyber warfare there gave the U.S. and NATO a clear ability to play cat and mouse, if you will.
So what about the shooting down of satellites or disabling them? How is that done? Is it done from other satellites or from the ground?
Well, right now they have the ability to do it from the ground. But they also are putting in place systems like the X-37B, a military space plane that has demonstrated it has the ability to stay in orbit for a year at a time. And it would be able to go up and essentially wipe out another country's satellite while it's orbiting the Earth.
Is there any likelihood of that happening? I mean, you know, surely most of the satellites are actually not used for military purposes. They're used for simple things like sat-nas, for things like satellite phones and for communications around the world, for peaceful things.
Well, actually, most satellites are dual purpose. They have a civilian purpose, but they also have a military purpose. And so the majority of satellites in orbit today function on some level, some military purpose.
Is it possible to sort of go around, get on with your day without being observed by satellites?
If the U.S. wants to observe you, they have the ability to do so. If they want to target you, as we see with drones, for example, they have the ability to do so. They really have the ability to intercept all phone, fax, and email communications worldwide now, with ground stations like Menwith Hill that has that plays that role, and U.S. ground stations in other countries like in Germany and Australia and many others around the world.
The only trouble is, Bruce, they better cross their fingers and hope that it's not a cloudy day, otherwise the satellite can't see anything.
Well, I think that you'd find that they've developed the ability to see through clouds. They have very highly advanced technologies these days that are doing those kind of functions on a regular basis.
What are you actually able to do, Bruce, at all? Because ultimately you can't stop the US domination of space, can you? In fact, I seem to remember there's one of the slogans is total information awareness. And obviously that's what they want. They want to dominate space and they want to be aware of everything that's going on and everyone's personal data.
Well, you know, as Noam Chomsky often says, how can you expect the American people or any people around the world to do anything about these issues when they don't know much about it? So that's our number one job in the global network, is to make sure the public begins to understand the complexity and the sheer cost. The Pentagon brags that this whole, what we call Star Wars program, will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. Where while I was recently in your country, I saw a headline in one of these free newspapers that I picked up at the University of London that talked about massive expenditures that the British government is planning to spend on space technology. And where are they going to get the money in times of austerity? Well, it only will come from increased human services cuts in all of our countries. So this is the program today of the military-industrial complex to use very expensive space technology to try to control the world on behalf of corporate interests. But again, this is going to be very expensive. This is ultimately the Achilles heel of the Star Wars program, the sheer cost. Every time you build a satellite, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. You launch the satellite on rockets, it costs hundreds of millions of dollars to launch. And then now and then it blows up and they have to start all over again. So it's a very expensive game, and it's very expensive to keep the satellites and downlink stations all over the planet that relay the messages and communicate with the satellites and make this whole thing happen. So the cost is the issue. And the way we're going to end up defeating it in the end is by rallying people around the world to defend social progress and not to allow the corporations to raid our national treasuries to build these space technologies that ultimately only benefit those that want to extract resources around the world, control markets, and control governments on behalf of corporate globalization.
You're not going to do that, Bruce, are you? Because people will rely on their sat-navs now. We need these satellites.
Well, you know, shows like yours help us reach people, right?
I wonder if you could recommend any, because I mean it's quite easy nowadays to go on to the internet to find a good documentary that explains some of this, which has got some of the detail. I mean, particularly people who are interested in science want to know what is going on. So, are there any places that you could recommend or particular films to people who can get clued up on satellites?
Well, I think the first place to go is our website, spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org. And on the website, we have a video section where we have links to many, many videos, but two that I would highly suggest. One is called Arsenal of Hypocrisy, and the other is called Pax Americana and the Weaponization of Space. So Arsenal of Hypocrisy and Pax Americana and the Weaponization of Space, they're both also available on YouTube.
Now, I know you were over in Britain. You mentioned that at London University, up at Menwith Hill as well. This is up in North Yorkshire. I can remember I went to college up there, and from out of our library window in Ilkley, you could see across the North Yorkshire moors to a whole collection of these white golf balls, we used to call them, about 10 miles away from our college. And this has always been a bit of a mysterious place. It was first, certainly to my knowledge, looked into for the British people by the journalist Duncan Campbell in the 1980s. And he made a series which included looking at it called Secret Society, which actually got the Director General of the BBC sacked when that was shown. Obviously a very sensitive place. But what goes on? What's Menwith Hill all about, Bruce?
It has two basic functions. The first is, it's an NSA, the National Security Administration, a National Security Agency, rather, It's a spy base, spying on the people of Britain and throughout Europe, and also doing industrial espionage on behalf of U.S. corporations. And then secondly, its role is to participate in this so-called missile defense program, relaying information from satellites that will be put in place that will help the targeting of missile defense systems and U.S. first strike attack on Russia and China. Also, there's Fylingdales, also up in the Yorkshire Moors, that is a X-band radar base that is also highly involved in the U.S. missile defense program. And then a third place that I visited while I was there was down near Oxford. It's Croughton, another U.S. base called an RAF base, but it's not. It's a U.S. Space warfare communications relay base, and they're building more and more golf balls there all the time. And so peace groups out of the Oxford area protest there regularly.
Where is all this heading? Because we've got this thing called the Global War on Terror at the moment, possible conflict with the Russians, particularly either in Syria or in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, maybe even the Baltics. So it doesn't look as if war is off the agenda, Bruce.
No, I think the United States' goal is to take Russia down and take China down. Recently, I saw a video interview speech by George Friedman, the founder and chief executive officer of Stratfor, which is the sort of the privatized CIA. They brief private corporations, give them intelligence information. He called for the taking down of both Moscow and Beijing. Why Russia? Why take down Russia? Well, because they have the world's largest supply of natural gas. And don't we know by now that the Pentagon's number one job in the world is to serve as the primary resource extraction service for corporate globalization? And then secondly, as we see climate change, we see the melting of the Arctic ice. What country has the largest land border with the Arctic Ocean? Well, that happens to be Russia. And the oil corporations want to get up into the Arctic and drill, baby, drill. And so according to Friedman and also the RAND Corporation in California, that's a long-known military think tank, the idea is to balkanize Russia, break it up into constituent pieces so that they would have an easier chance to then get in and extract resources, both on the ground and from the Arctic Sea in the coming years. So this is the project. And so they're starting with, they started with Libya. Libya has the largest supply of gas on the African continent. U.S. and NATO took down Libya. Now they're trying to take down Syria. Iran is on the agenda, and then Russia. And then, as I said, China as well. So today we see a NATO expansion on steroids creeping up to the Russian border, violating promises that were made to the former Soviet Union when the Berlin Wall fell, that NATO would not expand one centimeter to the east. But Bill Clinton and a succession of U.S. presidents have violated that promise. So Russia today is looking at the Earth from their space satellites, and they see themselves being surrounded, as does China. And I believe that this current situation in Syria and the Turkish shooting down of a Russian airplane is one more effort on the part of NATO to create a war with Russia.
But, I mean, are they crazy, Bruce? Because, I mean, a nuclear war it would be if it was with Russia and China.
I believe they are crazy, in fact. The people that control the United States government today are not the citizens of the United States, but, in fact, it's a criminal syndicate, a corporate criminal syndicate full of psychotic operatives that work for corporations, that are blind to human suffering. And we've seen what they've done in Iraq. We've seen what they've done in Afghanistan. We've seen what they've been doing in eastern Ukraine, where the Kiev junta, the puppet government in Kiev, controlled by the United States, has been shelling their own citizens, killing thousands of them, innocent people. So, you know, we've seen what the U.S. government has been doing in Syria. We've seen what they do with drones in many different countries, killing scores and scores and scores of innocent people. So clearly, my government is out of control, And anybody that misses that is not really paying attention.
What are the American people doing to sort out their own government, Bruce?
I think they're very depressed. They're very saddened. And sadly, too, they're also under, many of them are under the control of the corporate-dominated media, just as in your country, where you have a scandalous media that is run by the likes of Rupert Murdoch. Our media is also run by corporate interests who keep people distracted with entertainment and hysterical fear-mongering stories. So that's the reality of our country. We do have a peace movement that has been largely demobilized by the Obama administration. Liberal Democrats in this country are afraid to speak out against their own president for fear that he would be replaced by someone worse. But in fact, it's my opinion that Obama has done the very same things that George W. Bush was doing, in fact, even worse, but at the same time offered the corporate oligarchy that runs our country the added advantage of having demobilized much of the left. So this is where we are today. And those of us that still remain active in the peace movement are scrambling, trying to do our best under a difficult situation.
Bruce, just remind us about where your website is, where people can follow some of your more of your work online. And I'd also like to know, actually, maybe before you answer that, what role do you think these sorts of attacks like the 9/11, the 7/7, London bombings and the Paris attacks have in all of this?
Well, you know, I've become a student in the last year or so of the whole Gladio operation after World War II, the U.S.-NATO operation to create terrorist incidents throughout Europe as a way to blame them on the left, to keep socialists and communists out of power. In fact, if you go onto YouTube and just Google BBC documentary Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O, you see a wonderful BBC story that unearths the whole Gladio operation. So I think that what we saw in Paris, what happened on 9/11, are these Gladio-style false flags. There's no doubt in my mind about it. I would suggest people, again, go to our website, spaceforpeace.org. That's the global network against weapons and nuclear power in space. And also I have a blog that I post to pretty much every day, especially when I'm traveling. I want people to know what I'm doing around the world. And that is called Organizing Notes. And you can find it from our website, spaceforpeace.org, or just Google Organizing Notes along with my name, Bruce Gagnon, and you should find it.
Well, Bruce, from the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. We didn't really get around to talking about nuclear power in space. That sounds a bit frightening. But anyway, maybe we'll do that another time. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans in the past. At the moment, we've been suspended until next spring from BCFM in Bristol. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Cleo Lake, Director of St Paul's Carnival, the poet Lawrence Hu, and Bruce Gagnon, you just heard there, from Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, his website spaceforpeace.org. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, just off Queen's Square. Call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.